Nobody's yet put enough money up for it to get their name on it. So if you want to think of the perfect Christmas present to LSE and you want to pool all your retirement pensions that haven't been sunk in various crises, now you know how your name could be remembered. I'm basically like a glamorised cabin crew personnel. British Airways, thank God they're not. And I have to point out to you where the exits are, and they're sometimes behind you. Facilities are in the main hall by the walking by the lifts. And should there be a fire drill, I'd be very annoyed about it, but there was during a Confucius Institute meeting, you will evacuate the building in an orderly fashion and proceed to the exit doors clearly marked with flashing lights. Anyway, enough of that. I'm going to be very quick because we are, in fact, running slightly behind schedule, the very much the academic 15 minutes of politeness. So I'll be handing over to Lyd King very, very quickly. For those who don't know me, I'm head of academic and professional development at LSE, which is a division that looks after the interests of the Language Centre, the Careers Service and the Teaching and Learning Centre. But it shows a very much a joined-up approach to how we feel that services, skills, education for students as a whole can be delivered. Very, very quickly, about 300 students do a language as part of their degree, language and society, literature and society, French, German, Russian and Spanish, and from next year, Mandarin. 2,000 students do a language as a paid extra, and many departments actually pay for their students to do a language certificate course in a whole range of languages, Japanese, Portuguese, Italian, you name it, Turkish, Greek, I've probably forgotten a couple, but they're able to do that. We help about 1,500 people with their academic English. We help work in projects like this, and we also do outreach programs for school and anything that will make money for the institution with the word executive in front. So we're all singing, all dancing, taking a big tranche, and we're actually working on a formal languages policy, very much an echo of the UCL one, where anybody who doesn't have a qualification in a language, in order to make sure that they feel part of the social world of LSE, that they will have access and will really be strongly encouraged, advised to do a language for at least 2 years at LSE, and it won't cost them a penny. So lots of things happening, and for me, it is a great honour to work with Lyd King, the language's czar. I've actually known him for 25 years, but he never knew me, which is slightly, I'm sort of a language stalker, if you like, there. Yes, I knew what he... I knows what he did last summer. And it is a great pleasure. I think it's a great project. This is our first outing, if you like. It is going to be interesting. It is going to be a talking shop, and there's nothing wrong with that if, A, you talk with the right people and talk about the right things and very much ask the right questions, and that's what we're going to be looking at. In many ways, in wartime, I would have actually said, write down a few questions. What does social inclusion mean to now? Spend no longer than 2 minutes, but I'll spare you those exercises. But we are going to be talking a lot, thinking a lot, because at the end of the day, we're not going to actually write you on learning objectives, but by the end of the day, you will have listened to some fantastic people, talked to each other, talked about important things, and really come up with a list of action plans, questions, ideas that we take forward. Thank you very much, and I hand over to Lyd King. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. Delighted to see you all. I think we've come from the north and the south and the east and the west of Europe, and similarly within England. Unfortunately, we have Welsh people, but we don't have anybody from Wales, as it were, which is... No, who has, you, no you're from Reading. You know, I say we have Welsh people. Yes. Otherwise, I think we have exactly the people we want, and also different types of people. More academics than policy people, inevitably, but we have both, and also practitioners. And that's the purpose of what this project is about, is actually to try to sort out together what languages policies are or might be, and when they work and when they don't work, and why they don't, and where do we go from there. So, and we have the leisure, because of the funding from the European Union, of spending a few months examining some of those questions. And, of course, we hope all of you will be coming back to talk to us in April at a conference and take part in a conference, and many of you will participate in the ongoing online discussions that we will be stimulating. I thought I'd just give you, although you've probably seen this, just very briefly, because we are running short, an overview of what is planned. So the project, how does it work? And as Nick said, it's very much a work in progress, and how it works depends on how people respond. So we've started that process of scoping what some of the key issues are, and you've had a document, only three pages at the moment, that is being expanded, and there'll be other things coming into that, and we hope you'll be willing to contribute your ideas and thoughts to it. It will soon be up online. We're going to have a dedicated website to engage with many people on discussion. I should say, incidentally, and if anybody doesn't like the idea, of course it might not work because we had a few technical problems already, our intention is that certainly the main contributions today are being recorded, I think I'm right, and we're going to have a look at that and put up an online version of some of the things people have said so that other people can take part in that discussion in the new year. So if you're shy or don't want your ministry to know what you've said, you better make sure that's said at some appropriate moment. So that's going to happen throughout the event. Then two seminars, of which this is the first one, as Nick said, it might answer some questions, but the main purpose is to make sure we've got the right questions. And we've given you a starter pack of questions. We want some more. And an outline for carrying on the discussion. So at the end of today, you will do all the things that Nick said, but if you feel dissatisfied because it's not finished, don't be, because it's not meant to be. Because if we could sort this out in a day, then we wouldn't need any commissions on multilingualism or culture or whatever else they're called. Incidentally, in relation to which I'm delighted, we do have a number of representatives from the European Commission. We couldn't get the Council of Europe itself, but we do have many people who work with the Council of Europe, so we'll have that input also from the Commission and also from the other main European institution involved in languages. We will then, as I said, develop from that the international conference. Academics among you might know what that is a reference to, unlocking the gates of language, and there's no prizes, and you can tell me at the end of the day. An online consultation following that, and then, importantly, dissemination through transnational networks. So we have two associate partners, as they call it, CERCLE, and the representatives from CERCLE here, and FIPLV, so the school sector and the university sector, as routes into dissemination in other countries. And already there's been a meeting in Italy, for example, to discuss some of these issues. There will be more of that going on during the course of the conference. And we hope, and this is something I want to flag now, and people who are interested, let's begin that dialogue, that we could establish through these discussions the basis for some more sustained dialogue through networks, the various opportunities that exist. That's not major for our seminar now, but it's something to be thinking about. Okay, so that's the project itself. Behind all our discussions today are some questions that we've already circulated, which I will just show you again. Something strange has happened there, but don't worry about it. Just to keep you on your toes and attention. We get the key questions after. So those are some of the issues summarised in that scoping document. Very important relationship of languages and identity, the effect of multilingualism on communities and community cohesion. This is our theme. I was talking to Joe LoBianco, who some of you might know. He wasn't quite sure that we got the division right. That doesn't matter. We have to make arbitrary decisions. We've said, let's look at languages from two perspectives and see eventually how they join up, or multilingualism rather. Firstly, the issue of community cohesion. Secondly, the issue of intercultural communication, employability, and so on. Those seem to us some of the key questions that we ought to be addressing in relation to languages and community cohesion. Questions which have become, I think, very much to the fore, and you'll see that discussed in the scoping document, in this decade. If you look back 20 or 30 years, these kind of issues were raised, but not with the kind of insistency or importance also universally as they are, it seems to be now. And also some of the problems that, challenges that arise from that. Are we in danger, for example, and that's an interesting question we throw out, there has always been multilingualism, but is there multilingualism for the elites, which is different from the multilingualism for the excluded? I think the Grand Tour was fairly multilingual back in the 18th century, for example. Are there monolinguals, and this is something that personally interests me, concerns me greatly, monolinguals who are being excluded by being monolingual, and why does that matter? And the question of language equality, are languages equal, and how do we support language maintenance? So some big questions, some big social questions. Delighted we'll be hearing from Keith Ajegbo later on, looking at this from his perspective, which isn't languages in itself, but social cohesion and seeing how these things fit together. So as I said, I think the agenda is a very exciting one. We were going to ask you to now do this little group task of deciding among yourselves what social cohesion means or what would it look like if you saw it walking down the street. We probably don't have time to do that, but I will throw that out as a thought. Why don't you be thinking that and see whether the discussions that we have today relate to your preconceptions, conceptions about what that might be. I think that's it, except to say, just mirroring what Nick had to say, what are our objectives? I used to be a teacher. I'm so glad I'm not a teacher now, because teachers always have to start off their lesson with putting objectives on the board. But I thought I'd do it anyway, because there is somebody here from the DCSF, and he might be, and I've got a contract with the DCSF, and he might say, didn't have any objectives. I'm sure he wouldn't. Colin is a wonderful chap. Key objectives, have an open discussion. And I think there is, we do have a colleague here from the press, but I don't think, Richard, people need to be worried that they can't talk openly about anything they want to. Richard is a good friend and very interested in these things. To find some more questions, to spend a pleasant day, and to keep warm and make it home. So there are our objectives. We'll see whether we met them at the end. I'm now going to pass over to Anne Corbett from LSE, who is going to chair. We were going to all be here as a long table ronde, you know, the French table ronde, but we decided not to because it was a bit uncomfortable. So the table ronde has kind of spread round the corners, but Anne will be there to chair it. And in fact, we're all going to come up here one after each other to say things. If we then come together again for any discussion we have left, that's how we'll do it. But I think we can play it by ear. So thank you very much, and over to Anne.
Thank you, Lyd, and hello, everybody, and welcome to a session in which perhaps it's just worth emphasising the words in the title as theory to policy, developing and implementing a strategy. We have three very well-qualified people to talk on this, and they'll be talking for a strict quarter of an hour each. And it will start with Francis Gouillet, who is an Inspector General de l'Éducation Nationale from Paris and will be showing us how we should all speak French. We have Lyd King, who you, of course, all know, and we have David Little, who made the Trinity College Dublin Language Centre a beacon and goes on spreading the word. I'm particularly pleased as a political scientist that the words theory and strategy are in this session because I think that it does emphasise that what one is looking at are questions of visions or an image of what the issue is and how one can change it if we think that's what needs to be done. It does encourage us to think about policy change and the elements of that. And perhaps you'll be talking more about implementation and what is possible this afternoon. I don't want to take up more time at this stage, and I hope and I'm sure that our speakers will stick to their time limits so that we do have a few minutes for questions and discussion at the end, with the idea that we do end at 11:30. Thank you. So, Francis?
Just very, very quickly, translators, interpreters are working. Your microphones are already plugged in. You simply turn it on, which is this here, and then turn it to the appropriate channel, one or two, depending whether you want it in English or French. Voilà, c'est tout.
Merci beaucoup. Donc je laisse chacun le temps de prendre les écouteurs pour l'interprétation si nécessaire. En tout cas, je commence par le plaisir de vous saluer, puis de remercier les organisateurs de cette invitation, et puis de l'honneur un peu périlleux de commencer cette série de présentations. Mon propos n'est pas bien évidemment de me livrer à des réflexions personnelles sur le sujet passionnant qui est proposé, mais d'essayer très brièvement de dresser un peu un bilan de la situation de la politique linguistique éducative en France sous l'angle de la cohésion sociale. C'est-à-dire, quel est le rôle en France des langues vivantes dans cette problématique de la cohésion sociale ? Ce qui ne veut pas dire qu'elle soit posée dans ces termes dans la politique éducative, mais je pense qu'il y a des éléments importants que l'on peut dégager de la réalité. Et tout d'abord, en commençant par une évidence, je crois, qui pour tous les pays, c'est que la cohésion sociale passe, bien évidemment, par l'accès du tous ou de plus grand nombre à un niveau de formation et de qualification. Donc la cohésion sociale passe par la réussite scolaire. C'est un des fondements, un de ce qu'on appellerait en France l'idéal républicain, de permettre cette cohésion par la réussite scolaire de tous sans exception. Et dans cette perspective, on s'aperçoit très vite que les langues en France, dans le système éducatif, jouent pour le coup un rôle très important. Non pas explicitement en cohésion sociale, mais pour la réussite scolaire. Je voudrais juste donner deux exemples, deux illustrations. Première illustration, nous sommes en train de réformer ce mois-ci le lycée, donc l'enseignement secondaire supérieur, et on s'aperçoit, et c'est indiqué ici par la flèche, que la seule discipline qui soit indiquée comme un axe fondamental de cette réforme des lycées, ce sont les langues étrangères. On ne parle pas des mathématiques, on ne parle pas du français, on ne parle pas de l'histoire-géographie, on parle des langues étrangères. Deuxième exemple, illustration de ce propos, de l'importance des langues par rapport à la réussite scolaire, c'est les grilles horaires. J'ai pris une classe de la réforme. On voit, les langues vivantes sont la discipline qui a l'horaire le plus important. Il y a plus d'heures pour les langues vivantes étrangères que pour les mathématiques, que pour le français, que pour toute autre discipline. Il y en a bien un changement dans la représentation qui assure implicitement, voire de façon claire, un rôle extrêmement important aux langues vivantes par rapport à la réussite scolaire, donc pour la cohésion sociale. Alors pourquoi c'est important ? Je crois qu'il y a deux raisons que je pourrais expliquer brièvement. D'une part, une prise de conscience assez récente en France de l'importance de la maîtrise de langue étrangère. Pour paraphraser une phrase que vous connaissez sans doute, je dirais qu'on a pris conscience depuis seulement 30 ans à peu près en France que « French is not enough ». Ça peut paraître ridicule, mais un des obstacles majeurs en France, très longtemps, a été la permanence dans, au niveau culturel que le français suffisait pour la mobilité internationale. Alors que ce n'était plus une réalité depuis longtemps, mais dans les esprits, ça dure beaucoup plus longtemps que la réalité internationale et sociale. Donc c'était un des obstacles majeurs. Et puis deuxième raison, c'est qui est complémentaire, c'est l'angoisse de la société française par rapport au manque de compétences des jeunes français. Juste un exemple pour montrer dans quels termes c'est posé. Un article du journal Le Monde de cet été, bon, juste pour le titre, qui montre dans quels termes ça se pose. C'est-à-dire cette panique qui traverse l'ensemble de la société sur l'absence de compétences en langue dramatique et qui met en cause, bien sûr, la possibilité de la France de jouer son rôle au niveau européen, au niveau mondial, pour la compétitivité européenne, ainsi que dans le dialogue et dans les défis qui se posent à l'Europe. Donc il y a ces deux raisons qui font qu'il y a une urgence par rapport aux langues, et que les langues jouent cette importance prioritaire dans les discours politiques sur l'éducation actuellement en France. Alors, par rapport à ce constat, avons-nous une stratégie ? Je dirais non. Nous n'avons pas de stratégie d'ensemble. Il y a des axes, il y a des priorités qui sont complémentaires et qui, dans la mesure où il n'y a pas de stratégie d'ensemble, qui peuvent parfois se concurrencer, voire s'opposer. Je vais très brièvement, bien sûr, en étant très, très bref, hein, donc en résumant, définir un petit peu ces quatre axes importants qui me semblent résumer la politique des langues en France, et donc avec, toujours en liaison avec la cohésion sociale. Tout d'abord, c'est la prise de conscience, bien sûr, de la problématique spécifique de la langue de scolarisation. Il n'y a pas de réussite scolaire s'il n'y a pas maîtrise du français. Ceci était une évidence toujours. On a toujours posé, par exemple, le postulat était tout professeur en France de mathématiques, d'histoire, d'éducation physique est professeur de français. C'était le postulat, l'axiome. Ceci, et du coup, il était d'ailleurs interdit en France, sauf mesure dérogatoire, sauf pour les langues régionales, d'enseigner une discipline en dehors du français. Dans la Constitution française est inscrit le français est la langue de la République. Donc tout enseignement devait être obligatoirement dispensé en français. On a une évolution très sensible par rapport à cette grammatique dans deux sens. Tout d'abord, nous avons pris conscience du besoin d'accompagnement des élèves, surtout des enfants migrants, en français langue seconde, et nous avons maintenant une reconnaissance officielle de la qualification des professeurs de toutes les disciplines en français langue seconde. Et deuxièmement, nous venons, il y a quelques semaines, d'adopter un décret qui autorise tout professeur à enseigner ces disciplines dans une langue étrangère. Il y a donc un changement dans la représentation qui montre bien qu'il y a prise de conscience de l'articulation complexe mais déterminante entre les contenus disciplinaires et la maîtrise de la langue. Et je crois que cette question de langue scolarisation, elle fait partie à part entière de la question des langues, de la cohésion sociale, et ça nous renvoie bien sûr au projet du Conseil de l'Europe concernant les langues de scolarisation, qui devrait enrichir nos réflexions collectives sur la problématique des langues vivantes. Le deuxième axe, c'est celui, bien sûr, dans lequel je serai le plus prolixe, c'est l'obsession de trouver les moyens d'augmenter les compétences en langue au pluriel chez tous les élèves. J'ai mis en gras chez tous les élèves, c'est le postulat de départ. Nos élites parlent des langues étrangères, mais je crois qu'on peut dire qu'en France, il n'y a pas de construction des élites par les langues étrangères. Il y a bien cette idée fondamentale que les compétences en langue sont essentielles pour tous les élèves, quels qu'ils soient. Et quelle que soit leur filière, quel que soit leur niveau de qualification, tous les élèves apprennent au moins une langue vivante étrangère. De l'école primaire jusqu'à la fin de leur formation, l'enseignement général comme l'enseignement professionnel. Là, c'est les statistiques de la rentrée 2008. On voit que, sauf les enfants qui ont un handicap ou des problèmes très très particuliers, tous les élèves ont l'obligation d'apprendre au moins une langue vivante étrangère, et il n'y a pas d'examen ou très très peu d'examens qui n'introduisent pas, qui ne comportent pas une épreuve obligatoire de langue vivante étrangère. Ça repose sur cette idée que les compétences en langue sont une condition essentielle pour la réussite de chacun et donc pour, indirectement, pour la cohésion sociale. En particulier, des évolutions assez récentes qui font que désormais, la langue vivante étrangère est une discipline obligatoire à l'école primaire, sans exception. Tous les élèves ont le droit, et donc l'institution a l'obligation, non seulement le droit, mais on le devoir, c'est d'apprendre une langue vivante étrangère. Et on s'aperçoit aussi de l'évolution, je voudrais très rapidement en parler, parce qu'il faut être bref, sur un changement. Jusqu'à présent, les langues étaient dans le système éducatif comme composantes de la formation, composantes des examens. On va progressivement dans une autre perspective. Les langues ne sont plus seulement épreuves à l'examen, deviennent des prérequis pour accès à des diplômes, voire l'accès à l'emploi. Juste deux illustrations. Pour être professeur des écoles, nous réformons beaucoup en France actuellement. Nous sommes en train de réformer la formation des maîtres, le recrutement des professeurs. On ne peut plus, à partir de l'an prochain,
s'inscrire pour devenir professeur des écoles si on ne peut pas apporter la preuve que l'on a niveau B2 dans une langue vivante étrangère. Donc ce n'est plus une épreuve qu'on peut compenser par d'autres réussites. Il faut apporter la preuve pour s'inscrire que l'on a niveau B2. B2, c'est le niveau du cadre européen commun de référence. Je n'ai pas l'équivalence en tête par rapport à l'échelle pour les langues en Grande-Bretagne, mais c'est simplement L-level. Bon. Et autre exemple, nous avons un diplôme national du brevet, c'est-à-dire la fin de l'enseignement secondaire inférieur. Là aussi, depuis 2 ans, aucun élève ne peut obtenir ce diplôme s'il n'a pas au moins le niveau A2 dans une langue vivante étrangère. Donc on est passé de l'idée de « les langues participent à la formation » à une autre idée qui est de dire que les langues sont une condition pour pouvoir accéder à une qualification et donc une obligation de l'institution scolaire à faire en sorte que tout élève, sans aucune exception, ait les niveaux de compétences A2. Ça ne veut pas dire qu'on y réussit. Vous savez, en France, on travaille un peu de la façon suivante, on met les objectifs, les obligations, et après on s'interroge sur la façon dont on va les réaliser. C'est comme ça que nous fonctionnons, c'est comme ça que nous avançons. D'ailleurs, c'est un moyen, pourquoi pas. D'ailleurs, on fait des progrès dans cette direction, même si, bien sûr, on ne peut pas toujours être satisfait des résultats immédiats. Par rapport à cette importance des langues, je veux dire que nous avons deux outils que nous utilisons de façon volontariste. Le premier outil, c'est le cadre européen commun de référence pour les langues du Conseil de l'Europe, dont nous sommes saisis officiellement par un texte de décret gouvernemental, donc à très haut niveau de décision politique, dans plusieurs directions. Premièrement, pour faire en sorte que nous de dédramatiser la question des compétences, de valoriser les élèves dans leurs compétences. Deuxième idée, c'est de fixer des objectifs réalistes, mais ambitieux, à chaque étape du système éducatif. Et puis ensuite, c'est peut-être le plus important pour nous actuellement, de prendre enfin en compte au sérieux cette obligation de faire progresser chaque élève en organisant, grâce au cadre européen commun de référence, les groupes de langues par rapport aux besoins, aux aptitudes des élèves et pas par rapport à leur passé dans la langue. Ce que nous appelons les groupes de niveau de compétence, c'est-à-dire que nous organisons le groupe de langues non plus par rapport au nombre d'années que les élèves ont appris une langue, mais par rapport à leur niveau réel de compétence en compréhension, en expression, de façon à faire en sorte que nous puissions faire progresser chaque élève. Deuxième dimension, c'est bien sûr la dimension européenne. Nous introduisons les certifications étrangères, Cambridge pour l'anglais, Cervantes pour l'espagnol, les certifications de la KMK pour l'allemand. C'est également l'affirmation très forte de la mobilité individuelle, non pas comme résultant de la compétence en langue, mais comme condition de l'accession à la compétence en langue. Et puis, c'est la coopération internationale et l'importance que nous attachons en France, même si les résultats ne seront pas en notre faveur, à cet indicateur de compétence européenne, car nous pensons qu'il y a là un besoin de cohésion sociale, mais également de contribution aux défis européens dans lesquels chaque pays doit apporter sa part. Et puis, troisième, parce que je vois le temps qui file, j'essaie d'accélérer le rythme. Le dernier point sur cette idée, ce deuxième axe de l'importance des compétences en langue pour tous, c'est l'obligation de plus en plus grande d'apprendre, oui, ça je l'avais déjà dit, d'apprendre 2 langues vivantes. C'est-à-dire que tous les élèves de l'enseignement général, scientifique, littéraire, économique, ont l'obligation d'apprendre 2 langues vivantes et de passer une épreuve obligatoire de langue vivante, que cette obligation s'étend progressivement également aux formations technologiques, professionnelles. Donc on a un nombre. Le seul point encore négatif, c'est le lycée professionnel, où très peu d'élèves encore, par manque de professeurs, peuvent apprendre 2 langues. Mais on va véritablement dans un affichage de cette obligation de 2 langues pour tous. Le troisième axe, qui est complémentaire de celui-ci, c'est la diversité. La diversité qui était un fondement de la politique en langue depuis des années, c'est-à-dire, pardon, j'ai été trop vite, nous offrons la possibilité d'apprendre à nos élèves, dans l'enseignement obligatoire, 13 langues étrangères et 10 langues régionales. Cette obligation, elle est statutaire, elle est réglementaire. Nous offrons cette possibilité. Et nous recrutons des professeurs et nous les formons pour l'ensemble de ces langues. Simplement, et c'est le sens de cet écran, on voit bien, et là on va tomber un peu dans les problématiques, dans les difficultés que nous rencontrons, on voit bien que cette obligation de deux langues ne signifie pas diversité. Et on voit bien dans le comportement des sujets de l'école que, en fait, quatre langues occupent le terrain, que toutes les autres langues ne recoupent que 1,4% de nos élèves. Ça veut dire que nous échouons, pour l'instant, à faire comprendre aux familles âgées que la diversité est une chance pour la formation, pour la réussite personnelle et professionnelle, et puis pour les aspects de cohésion sociale sur lesquels je vais revenir. Il y a là véritablement un plébiscite, l'anglais bien sûr c'est évident, mais également pour quelques grandes langues, et alors que l'offre, nous avons des professeurs pour un très grand nombre de langues, mais très peu d'élèves volontaires. Alors ça veut dire qu'il y a bien sûr besoin de continuer à expliquer l'intérêt de la diversité, et nous pensons qu'un des axes premiers c'est de mettre en avant les contenus culturels, y compris pour l'anglais, que nous refusons d'enseigner comme une langue qui serait déconnectée d'un espace géographique, donc d'une culture, alors que les tentations sont très fortes. Nous pensons que si nous ne mettons pas en avant le lien entre un contenu culturel et langue, nous n'avancerons pas dans cette direction. Mais bien sûr, on peut s'étonner du fait qu'un pays, bien sûr, en Grande-Bretagne, c'est une évidence, mais un pays comme la France a connu des vagues migratoires nombreuses, avec de très nombreux élèves d'origine étrangère, qui possèdent donc plus ou moins des langues différentes, ne se retrouvent pas sur ce tableau. Et ça nous emmène, bien sûr, à la reconnaissance difficile du patrimoine culturel et linguistique des communautés qui habitent sur le territoire national, avec deux directions très différentes. Tout d'abord, la reconnaissance des langues régionales, qui est récente. Dans la question, nous venons d'introduire que les langues régionales participent au patrimoine national. Donc il y a des possibilités dans les régions d'apprendre des langues sous des formes diverses, avec une minorité d'élèves qui sont volontaires. Mais surtout, là où je voulais en venir, c'est la reconnaissance dans les diplômes, en particulier pour le baccalauréat et les brevets techniciens supérieurs, donc au niveau professionnel, des langues d'origine, en laissant la possibilité aux élèves de choisir parmi un très grand nombre de langues, c'est-à-dire 22 langues étrangères plus 29 autres langues possibles, les épreuves qu'ils veulent passer au baccalauréat. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a l'enseignement de l'anglais, de l'allemand, de l'espagnol, de l'italien, mais au baccalauréat, les élèves peuvent choisir d'autres langues, les langues d'origine en particulier. Donc là, une reconnaissance, une valorisation de ces compétences. Et puis, autre point, c'est l'organisation de ce qu'on appelle l'enseignement des langues et cultures d'origine. C'est-à-dire que les élèves issus de l'immigration peuvent continuer à apprendre leur langue, mais cet enseignement n'est pas donné par le ministère de l'Éducation nationale, il est donné par les enseignants recrutés par les pays dans le cadre scolaire. On a donc un petit peu une sorte, non pas d'enseignement organisé, mais de reconnaissance de la valeur de ces compétences. Ce qui m'amène en fait à quelques idées clés qui, pour moi, ressortent, même si j'étais trop rapide, de ce très bref descriptif. C'est d'une part qu'en France, dans les décisions politiques, dans les pratiques politiques et dans les comportements des usagers, la cohésion sociale passe par la recherche de l'homogénéité. Il faut avoir les mêmes compétences que les autres, ce qui semble un ciment de la cohésion sociale dans la représentation. Deuxième idée, c'est que certes, les compétences des communautés linguistiques sont importantes, mais c'est une affaire privée. Que l'accès à la qualification à faire public de l'école passe par cette recherche d'homogénéité et que la prise en compte des compétences personnelles est plutôt une affaire qui regarde chacun et qui ne regarde pas l'école. Donc, dispositif un petit peu marginaux. Troisième idée, bien sûr, c'est que cohésion sociale, dialogue interculturel, on voit bien que les efforts faits en faveur de la diversité en France sont essentiellement des efforts pour la diversité des langues étrangères qui offrent des accès à la mobilité, à la formation. Je voudrais juste prendre l'exemple de deux langues qui reposent sur des communautés importantes en France, le chinois et l'arabe. L'arabe stagne, voire régresse, le chinois progresse. Ce qui montre bien que la seule préoccupation et les efforts sont par rapport à cette dimension internationale et pas du tout dans la perspective du dialogue interculturel ou la cohésion sociale. Et puis, une dernière idée, c'est que, pour le coup, puisqu'il y a ce comportement, nous cherchons à introduire le dialogue interculturel dans les langues qui sont véritablement enseignées, dans les grandes langues, ainsi que les autres disciplines, en disant le dialogue interculturel, il est à développer dans l'anglais, l'enseignement de l'anglais, l'enseignement de l'espagnol, l'enseignement de l'allemand, etc., ainsi que dans l'histoire des arts, dans l'histoire tout court, voire dans d'autres disciplines. Et puis, dernier point, et je terminerai par cette phrase, c'est de dire en fait que pour la reconnaissance, pour la cohésion sociale, il nous faut reconnaître la dignité des langues et des cultures des communautés qui sont sur le territoire national. Mais cette dignité, cette reconnaissance ne peut passer, selon notre expérience, que si on évite de faire un lien explicite entre ces langues et leur caractère de langue d'émigration. La dignité de ces langues ne peut passer que si on affiche et si on insiste sur la dimension culturelle et internationale de ces langues de migration. Notre expérience, c'est-à-dire que si on propose simplement ces langues parce que correspondant à des cultures migratoires, nous n'avons pas de plébiscite de ces populations qui évitent, pour éviter de s'enfermer dans des ghettos, qui veulent effectivement accéder aux mêmes qualifications que les autres, qui passent, puisque les langues sont importantes, par la maîtrise de grandes langues internationales comme l'anglais, l'allemand, l'italien, l'espagnol et autres. Excusez-moi, j'ai dû être...
Thank you very much for that. You've come a long way to say it. And there will be a chance to take up some of the issues you've raised. Thank you very much. So I pass the microphone immediately to Lyd King.
To terrify you, you're not going to see all those slides. Okay. Thank you very much, Francis. The English experience is very interesting, isn't it? And it's always quoted in Europe as the sick man of Europe. I don't know what David's going to say about Ireland. It's a bit strange, actually. I'm now going to answer my own questions, which is perhaps typical of the kind of sense of schizophrenia I've had over the last 6 years sometimes, as National Director for Languages. This started in 2003. I was appointed when just after the National Strategy was launched, and it was variously described as these words we use: driving forwards, coordination, advising, and so on. Well, I suppose it was all of that. It was very much about coordination, because we work in such a strange way in this country, don't we, that unlike the description of France that Francis has just given, we decide what everybody's going to do and then work out how to do it. We spend ages working out how to do it and talking to all the different people who might do it and finding the reasons why we can't do it, and eventually we move forward a little bit and we get somewhere. And I think that's something about pragmatism against Cartesian logic, I think. But anyway, we'll have another discussion about that. There is actually a civil service handbook definition. This is a true document, but it's secret. But I'm going to quote for it about, somebody said the Tsar. It says this: a figurehead usually related to a very high profile and insoluble issue whose purpose is to think the unthinkable, say the unsayable, and thus draw all the flak which would otherwise be directed at ministers. I don't know whether this is true or not. See champion. Anyway, why a strategy? Why do we have a strategy? In simple terms, I think this was mainly about the other theme of our series of discussions, the need in a shrinking society to communicate across borders, the sense that there was a languages deficit in not just England, but in the UK. So one of the predecessors of our national strategy and big influences on it was, of course, the Nuffield inquiry into languages in 2000, which we have a member of the group who was sitting on it, and he might want to comment on what I say later on. But I was just looking at the Nuffield agenda again, and it's actually quite interesting. it doesn't actually say very much about social cohesion. The chapter headings are about raising the profile, education and business, reforming school languages, languages in primary schools, new secondary curriculum, etc., etc., etc. But this, I don't think, was a major concern at that time. It was there, and it was always been there, some aspects of this, because of the kind of society that the UK is and has become. But our general analysis of at the time was slightly different. So I would say that by the late in the late 90s, when Nuffield was pondering, that was where we'd sort of got to in English thinking. I mean, that's a summary I did back then, so I assume it might have been right. That important, but probably not essential, a useful skill for all of those things. And it did, cultural understanding was the word we tended to use, rather than social cohesion or intercultural understanding, the things that happen now. And we also did think that it was something to do with communication and literacy. So that's sort of where we were. That's obviously very partial and subjective. But looking, if you look at the lot of documentation in the 90s about the new national curriculum, Alan Dobson's here, and he would have been involved in some of that as well. The new national curriculum came out in the 90s, work of HMI. It was really pushing to say languages are important, but something like that. So we should... since then, we've had our languages review, and again, you'll see some of those themes picked up again. Sorry, we had our national languages strategy. Some of those same things picked up, skill, business, communication, exploration. But I think we do have, at the beginning, when the strategy began, a deeper concept of the social significance of language, the social cohesion argument, the intercultural aspect. And we have this rather striking phrase that language learning and intercultural understanding, link the two, is an essential part of being a citizen. So it's putting it on the citizenship agenda. Whether we actually made anything of it is another question, but there it was. And the strategy, for example, said, actually picked out community languages as being one part of this mix, as had other documents. So it was beginning, to change a little. We then had our languages review, 2007, and the languages review, I think, made this much more mainstream. One of the important statements, that's the kind of guiding light, if you like, of the review, was the idea of engaging learners with language learning. That whole issue of what languages are for, a key theme of the review. And through the review, we've achieved quite a lot. I just want to summarise this so that we're talking about some of the same things, not that all of these are to do with our subject matter. So we've been looking at the structure of language learning, going towards a new paradigm of learning 7 to 14, a lot of work about primary languages, rethinking the offer, and that's include extending the number of languages learnt. And in fact, we can notionally do better than France, because, of course, any language can be in the curriculum. Not that they are, but they could be. And we have many, many languages which can be assessed. Looking at pedagogy, promotion, and making the case. Now, I've summarised as quickly as I can some of the essential features of our national strategy, which has mainly been about what happens in schools. In looking at the question of language and social cohesion, of course, we immediately come across a problem, because it's not all sitting in the national languages strategy, it's sitting in various places. And they don't always know each other or talk to each other. And that's the nature of the rather complicated democracies that we live in. So one of the other strands is something which goes under this wonderful name of EMAG, which is Ethnic Minority Achievement. And here's a statement from, I think it's the QC, the curriculum body's website. And if we had the time, we could go and look there on that website, and you will see lots of
and this has always been the case, public support being put into some one of the things that Francis was talking about, which was raising the level of what are described as ethnic minorities in that group. And the funding is actually very significant. It's many millions going into local authorities. It is mainly, and there are people here who know far more about this than I do, and in the discussions I'm sure they'll be telling you about it, it is mainly about English as an additional language, access to the curriculum through that. There are little parts of it which seem to manage to do things about the languages of the minority community as well. But I think that's not its intention. It was rather like Section 11 in the old days, where people used to use it to support community languages, but it was supposed to be about English. But the funding, nevertheless, is significant. Another strand that we all need to talk about is the whole communication strand. I'm delighted, of course, that Keith can be here, and no doubt he will mention some of these things later on. This has now become, we now have standards for community cohesion. It's something that Ofsted looks into. It's something that schools are thinking about and worrying about. And what that's one of the, I think that's an Ofsted statement there about what there's a definition for of community cohesion. The thing that is interesting, I won't say more than that, is that one has to make an argument to say, well, actually, languages have got something to do with this. The languages that people speak and the way that they identify themselves and who they think they are might have something. And you could maybe meet your targets for community cohesion by looking at your language policy. So, as well as language strategy, we have our other strands of strategy, with many of them housed within the same department that Colin and I have worked in, or Colin still does, and yet bringing that together is in itself one policy challenge. What about our questions? Now, I showed you very quickly the slide earlier on, the seven questions, how the languages impact on individual identity, the effects of multilingualism on communities, and so on. Are all languages equal, and so on? Now, I can't answer all of that in probably about 5 minutes, which Anne's going to start waving at me in a minute. But I think the English strategy might be particularly relevant for three or four of them. Firstly, the whole question of languages being a resource as opposed to a problem. Secondly, the kind of support that is given for languages other than English. Thirdly, the argument I already said that interested me greatly about this elitism and exclusion argument. And lastly, some slightly personal reflections on identity. So taking the first one first, multilingualism as an intellectual and cultural resource. I think we have quite a lot of evidence to suggest that this is something which has got into public thinking over the last 20 years and is very much on people's agenda now. Certainly an advance from 19th century views of multilingualism as being a problem, as the case, well, I mentioned Wales earlier, as the case of the attempt to suppress Welsh and other languages of the British Isles, as it were, or the Isles, in the 19th century. We've moved on from there, and we're beginning to think of multilingualism being an intellectual and cultural resource. The national curriculum back in the 90s actually quoted and supported the idea of community languages. And in our strategy, I mentioned it earlier, we realised that the range of languages spoken were a potential resource. Drawing on the skills and expertise of those who speak community languages will promote citizenship and complement the government's broader work on the promotion of social cohesion, is what it actually said in the strategy. I have to apologise. I was looking at this later on, and some of the slides have sort of got slightly wrong, but we're all among friends, so I'm sure you don't mind. You were supposed to be able to see that, but you can't. Similarly, when we looked at the key element of our strategy, which was the development of language into primary schools. Into it came some very important things about language and reaching levels of language and so on, but you will see developing interest in culture, and following that we developed a framework for language learning in primary schools in which this very important two little words appeared, intercultural understanding. And intercultural understanding has subsequently become a golden thread running through a lot of our thinking about language learning, right through from primary to secondary and into higher education, indeed. And it's something I think there's a lot of debate going on about now. What do we mean by this thing? Because it is more than knowing a bit about France, which is how we used to think of it in the past. Some of us who taught many years ago used to teach a thing called, it's one of the solutions for those who were not successful at languages, was to teach them French studies. And they used to learn the name of cheeses and rivers and do a little test in it. Well, we're thinking about, and it's very important to know about cheeses and wine even more, but we're thinking of something more than that, about how language, it's about language and identity, and different expressions of identity and empathy. And if you were to look at the newly agreed, decided, their proposals, which will be implemented over the next few years, that is one part of the teaching objectives for, in the lines of learning for primary languages, which is something that Colin was actually involved in, and you will see some fairly important statements for what primary school children ought to be doing. So the theme of multiculturalism and intellectual, I think, is definitely on our agenda. This relates also to the second point that I said I could consider in relation to the English strategy, which is the actual support for languages other than not just English, but French and German, Spanish. Is it having a real impact? Well, partly it is. I already mentioned the fact that there is no restriction on which language may be taught in schools. I think that's quite an important statement of principle. Well, there is a restriction that we want sustainability and progression, but there is no hierarchy of language. We provide examinations through, in particular, our famous Languages Ladder in all of those languages. 20, and actually it's gone up slightly more than that now. So 20 languages, including many languages of the communities. We've seen the growth, actually, of more, I think, probably than in France, of communities coming into the country actually getting qualifications in those languages. Polish was one of the biggest growth areas in the last GCSE examinations. And we've got support for, again, similar to France, and that'll be something you'll want to explore, I'm sure, for what we call the supplementary or complementary schools. There's been a project running, which other colleagues here have been involved in. You'll see some information about that later, about how mainstream and the schools of the communities, which we call supplementary or complementary schools, could work together. There is a lot to be done, and that's the project. That's what it did. And it was a very successful one. You'll see its outcomes. So the things are on the agenda, I would say, but we still have a long way to go. For example, we have only just won the battle with some universities to recognise all languages in terms of being valid for university entrance. And of course, there is a big debate going on about language maintenance as opposed to the need to learn the national language, and some tricky questions are revolving around that, which I think you will want to discuss. And that relates to the, you'll be glad to know, the two and last questions. Firstly, elitism and exclusion. Now, this could be something which is specific to Britain or to England. I'd be very interested to know from colleagues from other countries whether it is the case. We know about the English question, the idea that English is enough and the struggle to convince people that it's not. I think in many ways we've won that battle, but not for all, because it conceals a very important point, which is that we have always had very strong multilingualism in the UK, but it's been multilingualism for some. The private sector has never had a problem about language learning, as far as I know. the Nuffield Inquiry asked business what its views on languages were. Very interesting reaction. Yeah, languages are important, but we're not going to make it... we're not going to give actual support for our workforces to learn it. That's not our business. However, when asked the question, what about your children? Of course, our children all learn languages. And I think current tendencies, not time to go into now, are actually could be exacerbating that. That the children, pupils going through to 16 and beyond, learning languages of all kinds, are skewing towards private sector, selective schools, and so on. And that's a big challenge for us and something we're trying to do things about. And I also have a concern about the exclusion of the monolingual, because the monolingual tends to be of a certain class. There tend to be quite a lot of boys involved in them. And I think that not only underlines the social importance of this issue, but also its complexity. We're talking about a very wide range of people for whom language... And it was a quotation that I missed from our Deering Review, as it's called. Language is the access to communication, is the access to so many opportunities. If there are people excluded from those opportunities, either because they don't have access to the country in which they're living, or because they are excluded from the rest of the multilingual world, which actually isn't out there but is in here, then we have some big social problems. So I would say giving us a mark, because we have to mark, I think there has been movement. I think we've made progress. I think there's a lot of understanding about what the issues are. I talk to a lot of head teachers about these things, but we are quite clearly not there. And I fear, my fear is that the current conjuncture of economic pressures and social tensions could mean that languages, language issues, education is pushed to the side. And it's very interesting that both in England and France, we have had very intense debates recently about what is our identity. And that identity seems to be moving away from the idea that identities could be multiple, which is not an issue or a problem that our primary school children find, into the search for Britishness or Frenchness. And I think that Sarkozy has recently launched such a campaign. That's very interesting, very challenging for us, because I think instinctively we feel that multilingualism is good, multiculturalism is good, and multiple is possible. I think we know that it is, but putting that into the political sphere is an interesting and big challenge. And I hope I can end with a slide that I've used many times but never tire of doing it, which sums this up in the word of a child. Why is all of this important? And it's the perception of a teenage child back in the year 2000, who I actually came across. I think actually The Independent reported it, Richard. It was somebody who was arrested, aged about 16 or 17, having been fighting with Germans at a football match in Belgium. And asked why he did it, he answered, well, this foreign geezer said yak, yak, yak in some language, so I hit him. Which is a very sad indictment of our education system, really, isn't it? Contrasted with what children in primary school are telling us over and over again is, I want to learn, I want to understand. That's what we need to get into our education system. That is, I think, one of our big challenges. So it's not yak, 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 so I hit him, but what a child actually said to me, I used to think it was funny when I heard people in the street speaking different languages. Now I listen to see if I can understand them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lyd. We'll be listening to David Little when he can get to the computer. I think we've squeezed a few minutes more from the organisers for a discussion at the end, which means that you have a little less coffee, but more intellectual food.
We started, ladies and gentlemen, with French Cartesianism. You've just had a dose of British empiricism, it's my job to remind you that however difficult the challenges you face may seem, and however intractable the problems, there's always someone worse off than yourself. When Lyd invited me to attend this seminar back in September, I looked at my diary. There was nothing there. I said, yes. But I said, what do you want me to do? He said, I'll let you know. A little later, he said, I'd like you to tell us about language policy, language education policy in Ireland. On the screen, you see my response. One of the services that the Council of Europe offers to member states is the so-called language education policy profile, which is a protracted, interactive consultation process that is intended to begin with the identification of high-level values from which principles are drawn, which generate aims. Aims are converted into high-level strategies. Strategies are then used as the basis for implementation plans. And in an ideal world, of course, implementation plans are drawn up with procedures for empirical evaluation built in. And at the end of an agreed period, everything is brought into review and the cycle turns again. Not where I come from, it doesn't. Let me tell you a little, and I will try to be as brief as I possibly can, about the situation that causes me profound depression. Ireland and language education. Well, Ireland has, of course, policies regarding the Irish language, but it doesn't have a general languages policy, far less a language education policy. There's no national curriculum. Only three school subjects are compulsory. Schools must teach Irish, English, mathematics. What they do after that is up to them. Of course, what they teach in secondary schools is driven pretty well by the entrance and matriculation requirements of third level. The fact is that from the beginning of primary schooling, which with us is 4.5, to the end of post-primary schooling, 18 or so, everyone must learn Irish. I have 5 grown-up children who between them have spent more than 70 years failing to become communicatively proficient in Irish. And that, I'm afraid, is a sad reflection on our situation. There's a television advertisement for Carlsberg, which you probably don't see here, but which goes down very well in Ireland, in which a group of backpackers drawn from different countries come together in a bar, and they begin to entertain one another with traditional songs. And then it's the turn of the Irish, and they look at one another in puzzlement, and then one of them suddenly has a bright idea. And going into the little space that they've created as a performance area, he does a sort of rap in which he spills out all the words he can remember from his Irish classes. It's a sad reflection that for most Irish school leavers, the one benefit they get from having spent all those years failing to become proficient in Irish is access to a sufficient vocabulary to enable them to construct a pidgin to communicate with one another to the mystification of others when they're abroad. My 3rd and 4th daughters did this in a restaurant in Thailand where they thought the waiter was eavesdropping too much on their conversation. And then he came even closer. And he too produced a string of Irish words, obscenities as it turned out, that he'd learned from the last lot of backpackers. Foreign languages survive in our post-primary system because the National University of Ireland, God bless it, continues to require a foreign language for matriculation, though for some courses that is now beginning to crumble. Whenever the National University is challenged, it says, no, it will never give up on a foreign language. But 35 years ago, of course, the universities gave up Latin as a matriculation requirement. Within 2 years, there was no Latin pretty well being taught in schools. Many of the Latin teachers did the obvious thing and became teachers of French. If the National University drops its matriculation requirement, foreign languages will likewise drain out of our system. What the teachers of French will become is unclear. And in a way, worst of all, there's absolutely no national policy forum at which issues of language and social cohesion, language and intercultural communication are under continuing review. This is particularly sad and worrying at a time when the Irish demographic has undergone rapid and very significant change. Traditionally, of course, Ireland has been a country of emigration, a bilingual, bicultural society in which the majority culture is monolingual and monocultural. Then, of course, we had this Celtic tiger, and with it came significant immigration. New linguistic communities, and of course new educational challenges, beginning with the fact that suddenly there were large numbers of children and adolescents in our school system who didn't speak English. Now, of course, the Celtic tiger is well and truly dead, but the new communities remain. Politicians, I think, confidently expected that as soon as the economic downturn really hit, all these immigrants would go away. It hasn't happened. And the scale of immigration has been such that it is bound to make a long-term impact on the linguistic and cultural fabric of our society. And sadly, because a lot of effort was put in by some people, including myself, the educational challenges remain only partially answered. I want to come back briefly to the issue of Irish and also the issue of new communities. But first of all, let me say a few words in defense of language education professionals. Back in 1986, our Department of Education, the Ministry, set up a curriculum and examinations board. That, I think, in itself is revealing because it implies that you can handle the whole business of curriculum development and appropriate assessment without policy. One of the first things the chief executive of that board did was to establish a board of studies for languages. And in the report that the Board of Studies for Languages produced in 1987, there was a clear argument for an integrated languages curriculum that would embrace pupils' or students' home language, English or Irish, their second community language, Irish or English, and foreign languages. It went no further than that, which of course was a sign of the times. We didn't have other community languages. Most of the people who came to Ireland who didn't speak English were members of embassy staff at that time. Now, this argument has been repeated more recently by myself in a discussion document I prepared for the Curriculum Exam Board's successor, the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment, Languages in the Post-Primary Curriculum. And that discussion paper was used to launch a consultation process that produced an internal report from the NCCA, but no action followed. Partly as a result, someone managed to persuade someone else in the Department of Education and Science to apply for a Council of Europe Language Education Policy Profile. And that document, which is well worth looking at, the various things I'm referring to are all online, and the URLs are on the handout that I think has been distributed. That document includes a detailed exposition of the concept of an integrated languages curriculum, signed off by the Minister for education and science, no action. Let me say a little more about the case of immigrants. Here you see policy taking the form simply of funding allocation. By the end of the 1990s, there were significant numbers, as I've already said, of children and adolescents in our schools who didn't speak English, sometimes not a word. The schools were getting very anxious about this. They were putting pressure through various associations and unions on the Department of Education and Science, which came up with the idea that every non-English-speaking, non-Irish-speaking pupil, student, was entitled to 2 years of English language support delivered on a withdrawal basis. In other words, the particular pupil or student was assigned to a mainstream class, but then regularly withdrawn from that class for focused English language support. No one knows, I've been unable to discover, why that particular model was chosen, but my suspicion is that it had to do with the fact that it was easy to account. To begin with, the department took the view that schools were, after all, education professionals. They needed money, but once they got money, they must know what to do. But it turned out, of course, that more was needed, and so the department also had to fund various forms of professional support. For nearly 10 years, I was myself responsible for this organization, Integrate Ireland Language and Training, that provided intensive English language programs for adult immigrants with refugee status, but also did a lot of work to support the teaching of English as a second language in primary and post-primary schools. There's an enormous wealth of material there, at least enormous in relation to nothing, and that collection of materials can still be accessed via the NCCA's website if you happen to be interested in it. Rising from that, we collaborated with the Southern Education and Library Board in Armagh to develop a sort of a toolkit for inclusivity in the primary school. And that was going beyond English language support and trying to find ways of valorizing community languages that, of course, were popping up in all kinds of different configurations in schools on both sides of the border. We actually managed the first here. It was by accident. We persuaded the two ministries, Belfast and Dublin, to co-fund the publication of the toolkit we provided. And for the first time since the division of Ireland into two separate political entities, the same pedagogical materials were distributed to every single primary school in both jurisdictions. And the NCCA itself developed intercultural guidelines. But all of this was happening in a policy vacuum. No one anywhere was asking, well, okay, we're trying to respond to English language needs to begin with, but this must be only part of a bigger picture. What is that picture? How does our system overall need to evolve in terms of policy and practice in order to accommodate the new demographic profile? There were absolutely no developments in the mainstream to accommodate the very large-scale provision of English language support. In those 10 years that I was responsible for this area, we spent roughly €30 million of public funding. When they took our money away, as part of the death of the Celtic tiger, among other things, there'd been 10 years of very significant expenditure, some long-term gain at primary level, practically nothing at post-primary level. And if you really want to cheer yourselves up by seeing how badly off others are in comparison with you, then read the report that Zach Lyons and I put together based on an elaborate survey of 80-plus post-primary schools around Ireland. Then we've got the future of the Irish language. Recent census returns always come up with around 100,000 people who speak Irish regularly in their daily lives. The question is, it has to be said, phrased in a rather fuzzy way, which of course tends to push numbers up. Independent research may be too posh a term for it, but an independent investigation and speculation a couple of years ago put the figure closer to 50,000. Government-funded research carried out by my colleague John Harris has identified an unmistakable decline in the standards of proficiency achieved in primary schools. The one thing the research doesn't do is investigate what I'm fairly certain is a parallel decline in the proficiency of teachers. Not as teachers, but in the language. A new draft strategy for the Irish languages has been launched, and the goal of that strategy is 250,000 habitual Irish speakers by 2028. But the strategy says little in detail about how this will be achieved, and history would lead me to suppose that we will have all these very, very high-level aspirations, but the language will continue to decline. Four concluding thoughts. First of all, no country, not even Ireland, that's serious about social cohesion internally and the ability to engage with other countries externally can afford not to have a carefully considered and integrated language education policy. Secondly, policy development needs to be informed by expert opinion. Governments that disregard or dismiss expert opinion, your own government here is not bad at doing that, betray, as far as I can see, a serious democratic deficit. And in all the outrage that I followed through the press and on the internet following the dismissal of the government of the Cambridge Primary Review, I didn't see a lot that focused on democratic deficit. I may have missed it. Policy goals, of course, need to be evidence-based and realizable. It's easy to say we're going to have 250,000 regular speakers of Irish by 2028. Those who are saying it will all be dead by then, in any case, and the goal will be forgotten probably within a few years. And finally, it's very important that policy implementation should be supported by empirical monitoring and evaluation, because if we don't do that, and on the whole we don't, or we don't do it enough, we really don't have robust evidence to feed back into the next turning of the policy development, strategy evolution, implementation, planning, etc. cycle. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to all our speakers. As you see, I've solved the chairman's dilemma about how quickly you get to coffee, how much discussion there will be, and don't we really want to hear interesting speakers talk by, in fact, choosing the third and letting the interesting speakers talk. I would just like to say two words, and then I think it probably will be coffee time, and you will tell me. But I do think that in terms of objectives that were set out, the discussion that we've had has actually had some very interesting overlaps, and it's had particularly interesting overlaps for me from my bias that I was explaining earlier of being a political scientist and interested in European policy. Because I think that one of the things, and I picked out three words as key to looking at the underlying discussions about the vision, the policy vision, the question of how you change policy, and thirdly, the sort of political climate and how you use a context. And I would just like to say very rapidly that I think it was extremely interesting to see that a lot of the current discussion is in terms of multiple objectives as a way of thinking about the issue and really what has changed over the last decade. A second point which came out really interestingly for me is that what you need with your policy thinking is to have some sort of instrument or some sort of institution behind it. Maybe it's in the form of a Tsar who will then be shot down or not, as the case may be. Or maybe your point about a policy forum and the lack of policy forum, really what a destructive effect that has on and puts a stop to thinking. I thought that the other question which came out really interestingly was how do you use a context? I was just reading the FT before coming, and there was some eminent finance guru saying that, of some time ago, pre-crisis, saying that the real issue is how do you use a crisis? And I think that all our speakers have actually talked about pressures which do give you a certain political force in pressing governments or whoever the responsible authorities are to take a different line. Anyway, thank you very much to all our speakers and good coffee.
Again, I just found that absolutely fascinating, and I'd also like to thank Anne very much, because I know that she has so much more to contribute as well to the discussion, and of course there will be the discussion groups taking place on the 8th floor in the penthouse suite of the new academic building. You will have in your packs, I think, the lists of the groups here with the rooms attached. Lyd has personally selected all of you for reasons and choices not yet revealed to me.
Group two, I hope, is bilingual, because we decided we wanted to go to the group sessions rather than have a rather formal thing down here. If you're in group two and you couldn't cope with somebody speaking French, then you should make yourself known or move to another group. Or if you particularly want to go and hear somebody speaking French, go to group two. But all the French speakers, and as far as I know, non-French speakers who speak French or understand French are in group two. And the interpreters will be there to help in case there's anything terribly Cartesian that can't otherwise be explained.
That's it. So we have coffee outside. I will shepherd you gently. There are no express lifts to the 8th floor, but there is a section of lifts that you just take up to the 8th floor, and I'll be welcoming you. So if we try, we're actually not that far behind schedule. It's been a really good retrieval operation. So grab a coffee, and we'll be going up to the 8th floor, and lunch will be served on the 8th floor as well, with stunning views across London from the balconies. No, I take everything with you, yeah. I'll look for you, don't worry, relax, I'll find it for you. I have my hand up. Green flag.